your own.
Get ready to take notes because school is now in session. Tackling the biggest issues in education, this is Education America. Save the classroom, save the country. Here are your hosts, Headmaster Rebecca Hagstrom and co-host Abigail Johnson.
Hey, teacher, leave it to the home.
Welcome to Education America, where we're working to save the classroom so that we can save the country. K-12 education is the playing field where the battle is on for the future of our country. And as the 16th President Abraham Lincoln succinctly stated, the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next. And Abigail, we are so happy to once again welcome Dr. Carteris.
Yes.
Of the book Digital Madness.
Digital Madness, How Social Media is Driving Our Mental Health Crisis and How to Restore Our Sanity by Dr. Nicholas Carteris. Mm-hmm. And we are so thankful to have him with us again. We're going to pick right up where we left off next week. Welcome back, Dr. Carteris.
Thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So when we left off last week, you had just talked about how back in the day, girls got messages about, you know, body image kind of from magazines like Teen Vogue and Vogue. And you know, they came under fire, probably appropriately so. But a magazine sat on the shelf. You looked at it once. And now you talked about the amplification factor that social media has brought about in terms of all types of messages, whether that be girls' body images or boys being tough, or, you know, there's all kinds of messages that are unhealthy that are being amplified through social media.
And it doesn't just amplify, but it selectively targets the most vulnerable. So
yes.
It's as if that Vogue magazine, there was little elves that could pick it up and just drop it in the lap of a teenage girl who they knew was self-conscious about her body image and maybe depressed and maybe some other psychological issues. So it amplifies it, yes, because it has a wide reach, but it also, because of the algorithms, targets the people who it might most impact in mm-hmm. adverse ways because of engagement purposes.
Mm-hmm. And we talked between the after the last show, you mentioned to us off air that some research had been done, and it was found internal research at Instagram, I suppose it's Meta now, which is Instagram and Facebook, that they found that there was a 17% increase in suicide, I think you said,
it was 12% increase for British teenage girls,
okay.
Suicidality, and 6% for American girls. 17% was the increase in harms for eating disorders.
Eating disorders, okay. And you'd mentioned that there was internal discussion about this. Tell us on air a little bit about that outcome, and then what you just mentioned about Mark Zuckerberg just a month ago.
Yeah, so this is the part that makes it really a pox on their houses, because they had knowledge that how harmful this was, and what the internal emails that were revealed by the Facebook whistleblower, the so-called Facebook whistleblower, Frances Haugen, who was on 60 Minutes and testified in front of Congress, there was internal discussion that was saying, hey, look, our research is showing that this is hurting young girls, that it's increasing the suicide rates. Should we dampen down the algorithm and make them less predatory make them less impactful? And the response was no, because that would reduce engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So,
which reduces profits.
Yeah, right, right.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly. People over profit over people. And so now there are class action lawsuits that are happening that are relying on that intentionality, because it's similar to and that intentional deceit that happened also, because it's similar to what happened with OxyContin and Purdue Pharmaceutical, mm-hmm. and it's similar to what happened with Big Tobacco. Big Tobacco had their own research showing that tobacco was a carcinogen. They didn't disclose that, and they sold marketed Joe Camel to kids. OxyContin, Purdue Pharmaceuticals knew that OxyContin was extremely addictive. Their own internal research showed that, and yet they told general practitioners and doctors that this is the new opioid that's not addicting. Mm. And so those class action. And so before fentanyl, OxyContin was the start, was the tip of the spear of the opioid epidemic that we're still living and dying through.
Mm-hmm.
Those same lawsuits, the same law firms, rather, are now suing social media companies and big tech for intentional harms to children. And by the way, there's some acknowledgement from them because I'm working as a consultant with the law firms. They're willing to settle now. They're acknowledging that they've harmed kids. Mm-hmm. But the lawsuit is also looking for industry-wide change, yes, warning, yes, labels, and other types of changes. Good. And so this was brought up. You know, Mark Zuckerberg was in front of the Senate. And you know, the big tech oligarchs, they've been dragged in front of the Senate at least half a dozen times. And you get various versions of, we're sorry, we'll do better, we'll get back to you, and nothing ever changes.
Right.
And in this one particular instance, Senator Hawley was grilling Mark Zuckerberg, and there were parents in the gallery that were holding 8x10s of their children who had committed suicide as a result of cyberbullying or toxic messaging on digital media that attacked their vulnerability. And Senator Hawley said, are you willing to stand up and turn and face those parents and apologize for the harms caused? And, you know, Zuckerberg, it was a very powerful moment. He did sheepishly get up. He turned around. I wouldn't call it a full apology. He felt bad for their pain or something. I forgot what exact language he used. But, you know, he muddled his way through some ownership of the pain that has been caused to, you know, the harms that have been caused to kids.
Hmm. Well, good for him to do that. But as you've pointed out, where's the real change going to happen? And how many of these lawsuits are out there? And do you know what's at the core of the lawsuits? Is it like, in this case, you mentioned the pictures, 8x10 pictures of kids who had committed suicide. Is it a group of parents with that? Is it a parent group of parents with eating disorders? I mean, what are the core bases of some of these lawsuits?
Yeah, it's a multi-state, multi-law firm cooperative effort with several hundred plaintiffs that have all had their kids have either committed suicide or some kind of other harm has happened, psychiatric or otherwise. And the basis is that, you know, this wasn't they weren't accidentally harmed by a product that there was no knowledge was harmful. The products have been addicting by design. You know, we have now full disclosure from some of the remorseful tech oligarchs, you know, even in the documentary, The Social Dilemma, where they say, look, we made these platforms habit forming intentionally. We understand how dopamine works and how addiction works. And so we baked our platforms to be habit forming. And we also knew that these were harmful. And yet we you know, full steam ahead. So it's that they cause harm by intention and by design. And not only do they want some settlements for the families that have been harmed, but as I said, meaningful structural changes in terms of age, you know, can there be, you know, they have to have meaningful enforcement because you can't just say you have to be over 16 to be on social media without having some, you know, age verification. Aspect of it. So I think warning labels is the other thing that's being asked for. There's several things that are being asked for. There's a social media law that's being proposed that would allow people to opt out of algorithms, meaning I want to go look for something online. I don't want the thing online to be looking for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I opt out of the algorithm? There's some logistical issues as to how that would work, but that Senate bill, that was proposed by Senator Blackburn, Marsha Blackburn, mm-hmm. and Blumenthal from Connecticut were the two senators that have proposed the Internet Safety Act.
Mm-hmm.
So, but these are all, you know, there's a lot of noise and movement. None of them have officially landed yet, but there's everyone, I think, and I think what we're seeing is that there's agreement on both sides of the political aisle that something has to be done to protect the kids. Typically, Republicans are concerned about censorship, and the Democratic side of the aisle is concerned with misinformation, disinformation, but they both agree that the kids should be protected. There should be guardrails for children.
That's good. Do you ever foresee a day, Dr. Cardaris, that there would be no children allowed to be using social media platforms, like until they're 18 when they can vote or something like that? Do you ever see that day or something like that? It seems so impossible to me right now, but I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are.
Well, Florida just did that. Florida just passed that.
Oh.
Well, it's so no kids under 14 on social media, and for 16, they needed parental consent. So Governor DeSantis just signed that into law about a week ago. And I testified, by the way, for the Florida State Legislature about a year ago, and that earlier bill that I testified for was to remove social media from classrooms K through 12. There can be no social media in any class or any school device K through 12. Now, the counter argument, the Achilles heel of that is, well, every kid's got a phone in their pocket.
Right. Yep.
But at least on school devices. So I testified for several hours in front of the Florida legislature, and that got signed into a bill by the governor about 6 weeks after that.
That's good. How do they enforce this no kids under 14? Or are you saying it's just on school devices?
Well, the first bill a year ago was just on school devices. The one a week ago was in the state of Florida.
So how will they
enforce that?
Yeah. Do you know?
That's a good question. That's been brought up as again, the enforcement mechanism. I'm unclear on how they intend to do that.
Okay.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, I my hope is that people like you speaking out and others would bring such a groundswell of awareness amongst parents that they wouldn't need a law saying their child can't be on social media. I would love to see that day come where parents realize this is awful for my kids. Why am I letting them do this?
Mm-hmm. I wish I was the new organic fruit.
Yeah.
I wish I was the new, we only eat organic because we value our kids' health.
Yeah.
And as, you know, elitist as that can sound for sure. But I remember that, you know, when you're a young parent, everyone's talking about, Are you cloth diapering or not? What kind of sleep training are you doing? And how are you feeding your child? And that's, you know, when you have a kid under the age of 18 months, I think that's, you know, that's consuming a huge amount of your day. It can be a manner of one-upsmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And you just wish, okay, could this take fire, though,
wouldn't
within
that be nice?
Social media? Like, oh, no, we don't allow our kids to have social media because we actually care about their social and emotional development.
Right.
And that's a great point, Rena, because if you have to legislate behavior, then that doesn't to be as meaningful. But I am seeing a grassroots awakening and an awareness exactly with what you're saying, because I think now parents are beginning to realize that. And the Kool-Aid that was first drank was parents didn't want their kids to be behind.
Right.
And so I've got to drop the tablet into the crib because I don't want little Johnny or Susie to be behind the eight ball if they're 3 years old and they don't know how to code.
Yes.
But now you're seeing parents are beginning to realize that free-range kids with their brains allowed to develop organically and naturally are the better way to go. So I think we are seeing that more and more. And that's part of this tide. So now there's the class action suits because, you know, typically that's also helpful because that's in the past that's been helpful to, you know, because these corporations, you know, the tech industry, these are the most powerful and wealthy companies that have ever existed.
Exactly. That's why I was actually glad that you referred to them as tech oligarchs, because I really believe that they are. And there's more control in a lot of respects by these tech companies than there is by our own government. They have more influence.
1,000%.
Certainly.
Well, they're the gatekeepers to our minds.
Yes.
I mentioned in Digital Madness about how J.D. Rockefeller controlled an industry, oil, Standard Oil. He owned 90% of the oil in the United States, but that was a commodity. These folks control what we see, what we feel, what we think, how we vote, how we...
Right.
They shape... They're the gatekeepers into our soul, essentially.
Yes.
And who designated these five or six goofy individuals with God complexes to be the gatekeepers of our lives?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, well, I loved, and one of the things, just talking about the mind shaping, one of the things that you brought up in your book was, and we're going to do one more 5 minutes on the dark and scary, folks, and then we'll move into what can you do, what can we do.
Right.
But one of the things that you talk about really at the beginning of the book, but it's an overarching theme, is this sense of apathy that we're seeing within young kids today. And you have a Greek word that I am not going to try to say. Please do it for me, Dr. K, because I'll butcher it. the
acidia,
meaning this sense of purposelessness. And I think we see that everywhere now with younger kids that you can tell have had a lot of social media exposure. And one of the really local instances that you bring up with this that I think we need to just... we need people to know is you talk about how that apathy means that when you're spending time on social media, your mirror neurons are being compromised. And this is then changing your ability to be empathetic with people. And we're seeing this in the news all the time. Can you elaborate on that concept just a little bit more for us?
Yeah, so the development of empathy is a developmental stage, just like language, just like our attentional abilities. And so it's one of the distinguishing characteristics. Language and empathy, are many sociologists will point to those two things are what make us uniquely human. But empathy is developed during a key pivotal window, and that's when mirror neurons develop, where you begin, when the child begins to develop and grow and begins to appreciate another person's reality. And that's neurophysiologically leads to what are called mirror neurons, which are essentially the architecture of the brain that allows us to feel empathy. And sociopaths don't feel empathy, and people that have suffered severe trauma and abuse in childhood don't go through that empathy process. And, you know, on a spiritual level, you know, so that's the sort of secular neurophysiological explanation. You know, acidia talks also about sort of a spiritual malaise, an emptiness, a lack of purpose and meaning. And so to me, it looks like we've had very young people that have been overstimulated and desensitized. They don't develop their sense of empathy. They don't develop their sense of spiritual awareness. You know, I don't want to get overly, this is not a theological statement, but it's more of a sense of our common humanity. The digital also really lends itself to egocentrism and narcissism because the digital world is created in the user's image. And so, you know, if you're shopping for a pair of shoes and, you know, for the next 3 days, the algorithm sends you shoe ads, in a very real sense, it feeds into magical thinking. The world is, I think it and it appears. And so imagine if you're 8 or 9 or 10 years old, and again, your digital experience is curated for you, you begin to think that you're the center of the universe, because in the digital world, you are. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen that lead into a sense of self-centeredness and lack of caring. And now add in all the numbing desensitization of overstimulation that happens. Add in the lack of development within mirror neurons, add in the desensitizing content that's being overly shown. It's, you know, they're not just watching, you know, Disney movies, they're watching, you know, some very toxic content. So all that together creates, you know, you see these 8-year-olds and these 18-year-olds who have that dead-eyed stare,
yes,
who seem numb to the world.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, they seem numb to the world and are spending a lot of time navel-gazing, I call it.
Right, exactly. Yes, that's it.
And I will say, we have about 10 minutes left, and so I'm jumping now. Guys, we're moving into the positive. Please, get at your library or on Amazon, Digital Madness, How Social Media is Driving Our Mental Health Crisis and How to Restore Our Sanity by Dr. Nicholas Carderas. You will take 18 pages of notes. I did. But some of the things that I loved that you discussed at the end of the book, as I was just frantically trying to absorb all of it, was that I loved that you discussed, and we discussed this on our last show as well a little bit, that really the cure to all of this madness of technology is the ancient wisdom. And you talk a bit about that in the book. And then I want to just talk a little bit about, you discuss, what do we need to do to gain wisdom and gain resilience? And I think my new crusade, get ready, Rebecca, are you ready? this is going to be my new thing, is the new rebellion is going to be being resilient.
I love it. That was one of our goals of several years ago, developing resiliency in our students at Liberty.
And really, we need to make this cool again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I'll start with the resilience part first, because I think it's been a byproduct of the lack of resilience, or the fragility, you know, great book, Anti-Fragile, but the lack of resilience, a.k.a. fragility, has also been a byproduct of what's been called helicopter parenting, right? So you take the digital age and you take this propensity that now this generation of parents have to hover and sort of overly protect their children and to not allow them to fall and scrape their knee and learn from that. Because it's our experiences and overcoming obstacles that really helps us develop develop a thick psychological skin. And I call it a psychological immune system, in the same way that parents who overly protect their infants from germs, that child doesn't develop a strong immune system, a viral or bacterial immune system. The same way that if we're overly bubble wrapping our children and robbing them of real life experiences, of the ups and downs, of the slings and arrows of life, that child's not going to develop a strong psychological immune system. So now that child, you know, leaves home, leaves the helicopter and bubble wrapped environment, and goes into college. And this is a lot of the clients that I work with, the failure to launch profile, where now they go to college entirely unprepared to live in the real world on their own. And they begin to then lose themselves deeper and deeper into digital escapism, because they don't have the resilience to lean into stick-to-itivism. And so, A, we need to not bubble wrap our kids from age 3. We need to allow them to experience the world. You know, that's how they learn. That's engaged. We, I think, as parents have been scared that there's so many boogeymen and bad things in the outside world that we've created what I write about in the book, the indoor child. And the indoor child is not a healthier child. The indoor child is a more screen-dependent child. So we need to sort of let go of our own fear and let our kids naturally develop and explore and do and be and use their imagination and to be bored. And that is the generator of creativity and being able to kind of struggle and fail and do what you need to do. Then I talk about the archetype of the philosopher warrior. What we're also not teaching our kids that they really need to learn is the art of critical thinking. Social media is an emotions economy. What gets privileged is emotional reactivity. So it tickles the lizard brain. So anything that gets an emotional response, whether it's political, you know, a Molotov cocktail, or whether it's a psychiatric histrionic influencer, it gets an emotional reaction. But there's no room in the social media space for a thoughtful discourse about a subject that includes nuance and the gray area and critical analysis. And so kids just learn, how does that make you feel is all that matters. And the emotional reaction is how that matters. And schools respond to that with safe spaces and trigger warnings. You know, I'm teaching at the university level again. I'd been a professor for 10 years. I was out of the classroom for 10 years running treatment programs, and I'm back teaching at Stony Brook again this year. And I'm shocked and horrified at my graduate students to see how fragile they are, quite honestly. They are not in a good place. And they're in graduate school to be mental health practitioners. And so you see that fragility that I'm talking about. So the philosopher warrior archetype is, what are the traits of the philosopher? Critical thinking, ethical correctness, discernment, combined with, you know, the archetype of the warrior. And it can be cross-cultural, but here we get the Spartan. And it's, you know, Angela Duckworth was the wonderful psychologist who did all the research on grit. And she studied West Point cadets. And what is it? And grit, her definition of grit was the combination of persistence and passion. And so how can we engender a sense of passion in our kids so they're not blankly staring because they've been so desensitized by screen? So how can we find that thing that animates our children towards joy and moving forward, and stick-to-itivism? Because our children have to develop those muscles of, like, even if I fall down, I'm going to get back up and move forward. My parents are not going to cut my meatloaf for me while I'm 23 anymore.
Well, and so interesting. Oh, go ahead.
All those things.
I was just going to say, interestingly, neither one of those traits are encouraged at all through social media usage.
Yep.
Or gaming, stick-to-itiveness, right. Or I'm blanking out on what the other one was now off the top of my head. But both of those traits that you mentioned that are necessary to build resiliency and to build critical thinking skills are not present in social media.
Not only not present, the opposite is encouraged,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
As I said, if you're screaming that your hair is on fire, if you're emotionally reacting, that's what, you know, social media thrives and big tech thrives on weakened, mentally unwell people that are screen dependent, psychiatrically diagnosing themselves with a variety of either real or fictitious disorders, and who then become pathologized. Mm-hmm. And that's why I also wrote the chapter in the book about beyond therapy. We have so many young
yes.
people right now who are TikTok diagnosing themselves, who are almost embracing a pathology archetype, like they want to be mentally ill because mm-hmm. it's aspirational to be mentally ill. Some reverse cool way to have several diagnoses becomes, I mean, I have young people in my treatment program who are, you know, if you've got five diagnoses, that's better than four. You know, it's a reverse competition. So can we reset our value system to embrace being resilient and healthy? So a metaphor that I love is, we're not going to make the ocean less turbulent. You know, we're not putting the genie back in the bottle. We're going to keep living in the digital age, unfortunately or fortunately, but we can learn to become better swimmers.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we learn to become better swimmers? By strengthening our psychological immune system, by what we just talked about,
mm-hmm.
critical
mm-hmm.
thinking. And that can start at home. We can't subcontract that out to the schools entirely. You know, teachers are teaching content, and they're afraid sometimes to talk about ethics and values, and you know, these are third rail words sometimes in public schools, because you know, whose values, who, you know,
right.
becomes, because we talk about
we no longer have a common set of values, you
well,
know.
Yeah, so the education field and my field have become value neutral because mm-hmm. we don't have a common set of values, and everyone's afraid to get sued
mm-hmm.
if they speak out of line, so they just focus on content.
And in our last minute here, I'm so sorry, Dr. Carteris. Again, I wish I had five more hours of your time, but I know we don't. What can you help with parents? There's a wonderful section in your book where you do some bullet points. Could you do those with us, with the philosopher warrior?
In 30 seconds.
Yeah. Carve out time each day to allow your child to be bored. Have them, you know, I think reading philosophy is a great way to expand the mind in ways that are extremely helpful. Having a one day a week that you're unplugged and you're doing stuff outdoors and in nature. These are all sort of antidotes to what we're talking about. Getting involved in activities that are, again, whether it's sports or music or any other kind of real life activities. You know, these are all the ingredients that can help immunize your child from falling down digital rabbit holes.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we are so glad that we were able to have you on our show the last 2 weeks, Dr. Carteris. And again, find his book, Digital Madness, on Amazon or any other bookstore where you might find your books. But listen to our show again next week. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.